You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of this issue's cover story, Tour de Force, by Lev Grossman, with exclusive photos by Annie Leibovitz. By dint of advanced Sith interrogation techniques, I was able to obtain valuable advance information about the rise of Skywalker. Here it is, Common Emblem. Anthony Daniels, who plays C-3PO, is the only actor who has appeared in all 9 movies of the Star Wars triple trilogy, so if anybody's entitled to leak, it's him. Daniels says he loved the script for The Rise of Skywalker, but he didn't get it until the last minute, right before shooting started, and for some reason he just couldn't memorize his part. "My first line would not go in my head," he says. In person, Daniels is like a C-3PO whose preferences have been reset to charming and voluble. The line that I couldn't say was 2 words, common emblem, common emblem, common emblem. I would say them thousands of times. My wife would say it back. I just couldn't say them. Fortunately, C-3PO's mouth doesn't move, so he could add the line in post-production. Anyway, there's the big scoop. Common emblem. I don't know what it means either. Also, I 100% guarantee that they will change the line before the movie comes out so that this scoop will end up being fake news. Daniels also told me that C-3PO does something in this movie that surprises everybody, but he wouldn't say what. He keeps his clothes on. It's not like he suddenly does this thing, but... The only other member of the old guard on the set this time was Billy Dee Williams, who plays the charismatic Lando Calrissian. At 82, Williams has lost none of his roguish charm, but now it comes wrapped in a kind of magisterial dignity. People tend to remember Lando for the deal he cut with Vader in The Empire Strikes Back, rather than for his redemptive comeback in Return of the Jedi. And Williams appears to have spent the last 45 years defending him. He's a survivor. It's expediency for him, Williams says. You know, he was thrown into a situation which he didn't look for, and he had to try to figure out how to deal with an entity which is more than just a human. And he adds, with the weary air of somebody who has spent way too much time justifying the behavior of a fictional character, "Nobody died. Chewbacca is still here, too, but it's not the same man in the suit." The original actor was Peter Mayhew, a 7'3" gentle giant who was working as a hospital orderly in London when Lucas cast him in the first movie. Mayhew retired after The Force Awakens, and he died on April 30th at 74. His replacement is Yunus Suotamo, a fresh-faced former professional basketball player from Finland who always wanted to be an actor but was hard to cast because he's 6'11" tall. "When I first met Mayhew, he told me I was a wee bit too skinny," Suotamo says. "But we also had a Wookiee boot camp, which lasted for a week. He told me all kinds of things about the moves that Chewbacca does, how they came to be, and his reasoning behind them." Suotamo has now played Chewbacca in 4 movies and enjoys it about as much as I've ever seen anybody enjoy anything. It's very much like silent era film with Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin, he says. He's a mime character, and that's what he does, and I guess in that minimalism comes the beauty of the character. Next photo, hot take. Members of the crew, Shade and Shine Daniels, the only cast member to appear in all 9 of the Skywalker films, while BB-8 looks on. Other things we know about Skywalker, we can safely assume that the Resistance and the First Order are headed toward a final smash, which will be a heavy lift for the good guys, because at the end of The Last Jedi, the Resistance was down, way down, to a double handful of survivors. They'll face a First Order who suffered a stinging but largely symbolic loss at the Battle of Crait, and who, I feel confident, have learned something from the previous 8 movies. The Empire built and lost 2 Death Stars. The First Order has already lost 1 super weapon in The Force Awakens. Presumably it won't make the same mistake twice. But the stakes go even higher than that, cosmically high. Sources close to the movie say that Skywalker will at long last bring to a climax the millennia-long conflict between the Jedi Order and its dark shadow, the Sith. The hottest area for speculation, however, is the identity of the titular Skywalker, because at this point, there aren't many Skywalkers left to rise. 1 is General Organa, the former Princess Leia, Luke's sister. But Carrie Fisher, who plays her, passed away in 2016. That was a deeply painful loss for Abrams personally, but it also presented him with an impossible choice as a filmmaker. He needed Leia to tell the story, but Abrams didn't feel like a digital Carrie Fisher could do the job, and there was no way Lucasfilm was going to recast the role. Next photo, sandblast. Camera operator Colin Anderson readies a take for a chase sequence spotlighting the heroics of Chewbacca, BB-8, and Rey. But then a strange thing happened. Abrams remembered that there was some footage of Fisher left over from The Force Awakens, scenes that had been changed or cut entirely, and he dug them up. It's hard to even talk about it without sounding like I'm being some kind of cosmic spiritual goofball, Abrams says. But it felt like we suddenly had found the impossible answer to the impossible question. He started to write scenes around the old footage, fitting Leia's dialogue into new context. He recreated the lighting to match the way Fisher had been lit. Bit by bit, she found her place in the new movie. It was a bizarre kind of left side, right side of the brain, sort of Venn diagram thing, of figuring out how to create the puzzle based on the pieces we had. Fisher's daughter, Billie Lord, appears in the movies as a resistance officer named Lieutenant Connix, and at first Abrams deliberately wrote her out of the scenes in case it was too painful. But Lord said no, she wanted to be in them. And so there are moments where they're talking. There are moments where they're touching, Abrams says. There are moments in this movie where Carrie is there. And I really do feel there is an element of the uncanny, spiritual, you know, classic Carrie, that it would have happened this way because somehow it worked, and I never thought it would. The only other member of the surviving Skywalker bloodline that we know of is Leia's son and Luke's former Padawan, the fallen Jedi Kylo Ren. Kylo probably isn't capable of actual happiness, but things are definitely looking up for him. By the end of The Last Jedi, he has taken control of the First Order and killed, or at least outlived, his actual father and both of his symbolic fathers in art, Luke and Supreme Leader Snoke. Sources at Disney also confirm that his long-rumored Knights of Ren will finally arrive in Skywalker. And then he had been forging this maybe bond with Rey, Driver says, and it kind of ends with the question in the air, is he going to pursue that relationship? Or when the door of her ship goes up, does that also close that camaraderie that they were maybe forming? Darkness in the Star Wars movies tends to come from fear. For Anakin Skywalker, Kylo's grandfather, it was his fear of losing his mother and his wife. After two movies, it's still not so easy to say exactly what Kylo Ren himself fears, even though he's as operatically emo as Vader was stoic. He's fixated on the past. He made a shrine to his own grandfather. But at the same time, the past torments him. "Let the past die," he tells Rey in The Last Jedi. "Kill it if you have to. That's the only way to become what you were meant to be." Next photos, well met. Jordanian locals play the Aki-Aki, natives of the planet Pasana. Star-crossed, Kylo Ren, Adam Driver, and Rey battle it out with lightsabers in a stormy confrontation. Their force connection, what Driver calls their maybe bond, will turn out to run even deeper than previously revealed. Presumably, whatever's eating at Kylo started in his childhood. Maybe being the kid of literally the two coolest people in the galaxy isn't as fun as it sounds. Driver, who has obviously thought this through with a lot of rigor, points out that, as cool as they are, Han and Leia are both obsessively committed to lifestyles. Smuggling, rebelling, that don't leave much room for kids. He also points out that, unlike Luke and Rey, Kylo never got to go on a nifty voyage of self-discovery. Instead, he grew up under the crushing pressure of massive expectations. "How do you form friendships out of that?" Driver says. "How do you understand the weight of that? And if there's no one around you guiding you or articulating things the right way, it can easily go awry." But the emotional logic that governs the Star Wars universe, and also our own, Kylo Ren is going to have to confront the past and his fears, whatever they are, or be destroyed by them. Where Lucas's trilogies tended to follow the roots and branches of the Skywalker family tree, their personal saga was the saga of the galaxy writ small. The new movies have a slightly wider aperture and take in a new generation of heroes. There's Rey, of course, who sources say will have progressed in her training since the end of The Last Jedi to the point where it's almost complete. With that taken care of, all she has to do is reconstitute the entire Jedi Order from scratch, because as far as we know, she's the last one. If Kylo Ren can't be redeemed, it will almost certainly fall to Rey to put him down, in spite of their maybe bond. Their relationship is the closest thing the new trilogy has to a star-crossed love story on the order of Han and Leia. A source close to the movie says that their force connection will turn out to run even deeper than we thought. They're uniquely suited to understand each other, but at the same time, they are in every way each other's inverse, down to Kylo's perverse rejection of his family, which is the one thing Rey craves most. I think there's a part of Rey that's like, "Dude, you effing had it all. You had it all," Ridley says. That was always a big question during filming. You had it all, and you let it go. Rey is also, according to totally unsubstantiated internet theories, a leading candidate to be the Skywalker of the title, pending some kind of head-snapping reveal about her ancestry. For the record, the other leading unsubstantiated internet theory has the Skywalker of the title, referring to an entirely new order of Force users who will rise up and replace the Jedi. Rey seems ready for it all, or as ready as anybody could be. "It's nice having that shot at the beginning of the teaser," Ridley says, over avocado toast at a fancy Chicago hotel, "because I think it's quite a good visual representation of where she is now. Confident, calm, less fearful. It's still sort of overwhelming, but in a different way. It feels more right. Less like inevitable and more like there's a focus to the journey." Focus is a good word for Ray. On screen, Ridley's dramatic eyebrows form a wickedly sharp arrow of concentration. I ask Ridley what she's thinking about when Ray is using her force powers, and it turns out Ray seems focused because Ridley is actually seriously focused. I literally visualize it. When I was lifting rocks, I was visualizing the rocks moving, and then I was like, oh my God, I made it happen. And obviously there's loads of rocks on strings, so no, I didn't. But I visualize that it's really going on. That scene, which comes at the end of The Last Jedi, is another example of classic, non-digital Star Wars effects. Those were real rocks. It was actually really amazing, Ridley says. It was sort of like a baby mobile. There's also Finn, the apostate stormtrooper played by the irrepressible Boyega, who in person practically vibrates with energy and speaks with a South London accent very different from Finn's American one. In some ways, Finn has gone through a complete character arc already. He confronted his past by beating down his old boss, Captain Phasma, and found his courage and his moral center. He has had a tendency to panic, if not actively desert, in clutch situations. But at the Battle of Crait, he proved that he was past that. I think he's just an active member of the Resistance now, Boyega says. Episode 8, he couldn't decide what team he was fighting for, but since then he's made a clear decision. Cast members tend to refer to the Star Wars movies by their episode numbers. 4 is the original movie, 7 is The Force Awakens, and so on. Finn still has to make a clear decision about his romantic situation, though. As Boyega put it at Star Wars Celebration, Finn is single and willing to mingle. The movies have been teasing his emotional connections with both Rey and the Resistance mechanic Rose Tico, played by Kelly Marie Tran, with whom he shared a fleeting battlefield kiss in The Last Jedi. Rose seems like the more positive choice, given that she stops Finn from deserting early in the movie and saves his life at the Battle of Crait, and that the precedents for romantic involvements with Jedi are extremely bad. Tran is the first Asian-American woman to play a major role in a Star Wars movie, and she has been the target of both racist and sexist attacks online. But she has come through them as a fan favorite. When she appeared on stage in Chicago, she got a standing ovation. Finally, there's Poe, who has mostly struggled with his own cocky impulsiveness because he's a loose cannon who just can't play by the rules. Poe will have to step up and become a leader, because the Resistance is seriously short on officer material. Next photo, horsing around. Finn and new ally Janna Naomi Aki, atop Hardy Orbax, lead the charge against the mechanized forces of the First Order. It's extremely surreal to be in it, says Aki, and see how it works from the inside. In fact, some of the transformation will already have happened, where The Rise of Skywalker picks up, which is about a year after the end of The Last Jedi. There has been a bit of shared history that you haven't seen, Isaac says. Whereas in the other films, Poe is this kind of lone wolf, now he's really part of a group. They're going out and going on missions and have a much more familiar dynamic now. Star Wars has always been about friendship as much as it is about romance, and as of the end of The Last Jedi, Rey, Finn, and Poe are all finally in the same place for the first time since The Force Awakens. The Rise of Skywalker introduces some new players, too. There's a tiny one-wheeled droid called Dio, and a large banana slug alien named Claude. Oh, and Naomi Aki, Carrie Russell, and Richard E. Grant have all joined the cast, though again we know practically nothing about who they're playing. Going from being outside the Star Wars Leviathan to being right in its belly can be a dizzying experience for a first-timer. I actually tried to do this thing while we were filming, Aki says, where I'd go one day, walking through London, without seeing a Star Wars reference somewhere. And you can't do it. You really can't. So it's extremely surreal to be in it and see how it works from the inside. If anything, Star Wars is only getting more omnipresent. The franchise under Lucas was a colossus, but he still ran it essentially as a private concern. He could make movies, or not, as his muse dictated. He was beholden to no shareholders. But Star Wars under Disney makes the old Star Wars look positively quaint. Between 1977 and 2005, Lucasfilm released 6 Star Wars movies. When Skywalker premieres in December, Disney will have released 5 Star Wars movies in 5 years. I think there is a larger expectation that Disney has, Kennedy says. On the other hand, though, I think that Disney is very respectful of what this is, and right from the beginning we talked about the fragility of this form of storytelling, because it's something that means so much to fans that you can't turn this into some kind of factory approach. You can't even do what Marvel does, necessarily, where you pick characters and build new franchises around those characters. This needs to evolve differently. A useful example of that fragility might be the relatively modest performance of Solo, a Star Wars story, in 2018. Solo was a perfectly good Star Wars movie that has made almost $400 million worldwide. But it's also, according to industry estimates, the first one to actually lose money. In response, Disney has gently but firmly pumped the brakes. The first movie in the next Star Wars trilogy, which will be helmed by David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, the duo behind Game of Thrones, won't arrive till Christmas of 2022, with further installments every other year after that. There's no official word as to what stories they'll tell, or when a second trilogy being developed by Rian Johnson will appear. But even as the movies pause, Star Wars continues to colonize any and all other media. In addition to video games, comics, novels, cartoons, container loads of merch, etc., there are not one but 2 live-action TV series in the pipeline for Disney, plus Disney's new streaming service. The Mandalorian, created by Jon Favreau, and an as-yet-untitled show about Cassian Andor from Rogue One. I have personally tried a virtual reality experience called Vader Immortal, written and produced by Dark Knight screenwriter David Goyer. At the end of May, Disneyland will open Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, a massive 14-acre, $1 billion attraction where you can fly the Millennium Falcon, be captured by the First Order, and drink a blue milk cocktail. It's actually non-dairy. And Coca-Cola products out of exclusive BB-8-shaped bottles at the cantina. It's the largest single-theme expansion in the park's history. Take that, Toy Story Land. The Disney World version will open in August. You realize now that under Lucas, Star Wars always slightly had the brakes on. We were always kept a little starved for product. With Disney driving, we'll really find out how big Star Wars can get. When people talk about the new Star Wars movies, they tend to talk about how faithful they are to the originals. What's harder to say is how exactly the new films are different. How movies like Skywalker kept their connection to the past, while at the same time finding a way to belong to the world of 2019. Because regardless of whether or not Star Wars has changed since 1977, the world around it has, profoundly. There's a loss of innocence, a sense of innocence that existed in the 70s that I don't think to any extent exists today, Kennedy says. I think that has to permeate the storytelling and the reaction to the stories and how they're set up. It has to feel differently because we're different. We know things as a people and as an audience that we didn't know back then. For example, back then it felt sort of okay to like Darth Vader because even though he was evil, he was also incredibly cool. And the kind of fascism he represented felt like a bogeyman from the distant past. But now, fascism is rising again, which makes the whole First Order subplot look super prescient. But it also reminds us that fascism is not even slightly cool in real life. Evil needs to feel and look very real, Kennedy says. And what that means today may not be as black and white as it might have been in 1977, coming off a kind of World War II sensibility. In the Star Wars verse, dark and light are supposed to balance each other, but in the real world, they just mix together into a hopelessly foggy, morally ambiguous gray. Next photos, Punch It. In a historic reunion, Lando Calrissian, Billy Dee Williams, retakes the helm of the Millennium Falcon, joined by Poe Dameron, Oscar Isaac, Chewbacca, Dio, and BB-8. He's a survivor, Williams says, of Lando. Force Majeure. First Order leaders General Hux, Domhnall Gleeson, and Allegiant General Pride, Richard E. Grant, on the bridge of Kylo Ren's destroyer. First Look. Vanity Fair reveals Carrie Russell as the masked scoundrel Zori Bliss, seen in the thieves' quarter of the snow-dusted world, Jimmy. And Encore. Composer John Williams conducting the Star Wars score, drawing on themes and motifs he has woven across 4 decades. I didn't think there would ever be a second film, he says. But the changes are liberating, too. Star Wars doesn't have to stay frozen in time. If anything, it's the opposite. If it doesn't change, it'll die. It will turn into Flash Gordon. For Abrams, that means he can't go through this process so haunted by the ghost of George Lucas, who is, of course, still alive, but you get what I'm saying, that he winds up doing a cinematic Lucas impression. At some point, Abrams has to let Abrams be Abrams. The Rise of Skywalker might be that point. Working on 9, I found myself approaching it slightly differently, he says, which is to say that on 7, I felt beholden to Star Wars in a way that was interesting. I was doing what, to the best of my ability, I felt Star Wars should be. But this time, something changed. Abrams found himself making different choices for the camera angles, the lighting, the story. It felt slightly more renegade. It felt slightly more like, you know, F it, I'm going to do the thing that feels right, because it does, not because it adheres to something. There are a lot of small, subtle ways that Abrams' Star Wars is different from Lucas's, but if there's a standout, it's the way that the new movies look at history. Lucas's Star Wars movies are bathed in the deep golden sunset glow of the idyllic Old Republic, that more civilized age. But the new movies aren't like that. They're not nostalgic. They don't long for the past. They're more about the promise of the future. This trilogy is about this young generation, this new generation, having to deal with all this debt that has come before, Abrams says. And it's the sins of the father, and it's the wisdom and the accomplishments of those who did great things, but it's also those who committed atrocities, and the idea that this group is up against this unspeakable evil, and are they prepared? Are they ready? What have they learned from before? It's less about grandeur. It's less about restoring an old age. It's more about preserving a sense of freedom and not being one of the oppressed. The new generation doesn't have that same connection to the old days that Luke and Leia did. It's not like their parents destroyed the Old Republic. We don't even know who their parents were. They're too young to remember the Empire. They're just here to clean up the mess they got left with. The disastrous consequences of bad decisions made by earlier generations and try to survive long enough to see the future. Is any of this resonating with 2019? Might there possibly be a generation around here somewhere that's worried about the consequences of its own decisions for the future? Star Wars has never been, and probably never should be, a vehicle for political arguments. But to paraphrase Ursula Le Guin, great science fiction is never really about the future. It's about the present. Next photo, from the ashes, Mark Hamill as Luke with R2-D2. Speculation is rampant about who will rise as the Skywalker of the movie's title and how that choice will reflect the way the world has changed since Star Wars debuted in 1977. You could even, if you're into that kind of thing, imagine the story of the new Star Wars trilogy as a metaphor for the making of the new Star Wars trilogy. In fact, I was totally prepared, because I am into that kind of thing, to try to push this overthought, metafictional, hot take onto Abrams. But I didn't have to. Abrams got there ahead of me. The idea of the movie is kind of how I've felt going into the movie as a filmmaker, he says. Which is to say that I've inherited all this stuff, great stuff, and good wisdom, and the good and the bad, and it's all coming to this end. And the question is, do we have what it takes to succeed? Kylo Ren has it all wrong. You can't bring back the past and become your own grandfather, and you can't kill the past either. All you can do is make your peace with it, and learn from it, and move on. Abrams is doing that with Star Wars, and meanwhile, the Resistance is going to have to do that too, if they really are going to bring this saga to an end. Because we've been here before, watching a band of scrappy rebels take down a techno-fascist empire, and it seemed to work fine at the time, but it didn't last. The same goes for the Jedi and their struggle with the Sith. To end this story, really end it, they're going to have to figure out the conditions of a more permanent victory over the forces of darkness. Their past was imperfect at best, and the present is a complete disaster. But the future is all before them. This time, finally, they're going to get it right. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House on the Affordable Care Act and ice cream for breakfast. What is your idea of perfect happiness? No contest, seeing my grandchildren enjoying each other. What is your greatest fear? The current occupant of the White House. Which living person do you most admire? My husband, Paul, who is an enabler of the exuberance of his wife and five kids. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I'm not into self-deploring. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Discrimination, for any reason. What is your greatest extravagance? Very dark chocolate ice cream for breakfast. What is your favorite journey? Home to San Francisco. On what occasion do you lie to make someone feel better about how they look? What do you dislike most about your appearance? Gray hair poking out. Which living person do you most despise? I don't despise anyone. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? A phrase that I think is overused is President Trump. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband and family and the family I grew up in. When and where were you happiest? When I was raising my children. Which talent would you most like to have? To be able to sing with a good voice so that I could sing to my husband. What is your current state of mind, concerned and confident? If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? That I would have focused more on languages. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Personally, family, officially the Affordable Care Act. What is your most treasured possession? Photos of children and grandchildren, more and more. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Despair. Where would you like to live? Where I do live, in San Francisco, because it is heaven on earth. What is your favorite occupation? Doing crossword puzzles every day. What is your most marked characteristic? Being Italian Catholic and all that that entails, mother, pride, love. What do you most value in your friends? Fun. Who are your favorite writers? Bono, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Shakespeare, Doris Kearns Goodwin. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I'm not planning on that. What is your motto? Don't agonize, organize. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Nancy Pelosi. the players. Presence and style take center stage as veteran stars and breakout phenoms of this theater season showcase, The Power of Live Performance, by Brett Hennemuth, with photographs by Sebastian Kim, styled by Samira Nasser. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore, goes Howard Beale's Kritiker and Network. Bryan Cranston, whose role in the Broadway adaptation earned him a Tony nomination, says, in most cases, anger is not acceptable. We shun it. But at times, perhaps anger is the right emotion. This may be that time. Great art has always emerged from tumultuous times, and this season a cast of characters, 12 powerful performers and playwrights, hailing from Hollywood to the West End, are propelling theater to new heights, on Broadway and off, with 28 Tony nominations among them to prove it. With roles in adaptations of classic works to radical revivals and trailblazing new dramas, these thought-provoking power players showcase why, now more than ever, all the world's a stage. Bryan Cranston, role Howard Beale in Network, a stage adaptation of the 1976 film. Cranston describes his first onstage experience, an acted-out kiss with a girl who had a real-life boyfriend, as confusing. But that's just it, he says. The theater allows you to share a visceral experience among strangers as you go through a metamorphosis. Jazz Butterworth, role The Ferryman, playwright. Laura and I started talking about Northern Ireland and her family. The story just snowballed, and it reached the point where I had no choice but to write it, says Butterworth, who wrote the drama, nominated for 9 Tonys for his partner, Laura Donnelly, to star in. She got pregnant, and in 9 months we had a play and a baby. Laura Donnelly, role Caitlin Carney in The Ferryman. Over spaghetti and meatballs that Jez cooked and 6 bottles of wine, we talked about this idea, says Donnelly, who plays the widow of a man disappeared by the Irish Republican Army. I'm surprised we remembered every bit of it the next day, but by the time we began rehearsals, I just knew Caitlin's mind already and the process it took to create her. Audra McDonald, role Frankie and Terrence McNally's Frankie and Johnny in the Clair de Lune. I think the play is, in some ways, more poignant and resonant now than it was 30 years ago, says McDonald, whose pre-stage prep is total silence. She's done more than 12 Broadway shows. We're in an era where we're all so disconnected and lonely. People are just dying to connect. Karen Olivo, role Satine in Moulin Rouge. When you go to the theater, the live experience is a conversation, says Olivo, who credits Dreamgirls as the first show to make an impact on her. So you think, I'm not going to be able to tell them to stop, and if I walk out, I'm only going to embarrass myself. Celia Keenan-Bolger, role Scout Finch in Aaron Sorkin's To Kill a Mockingbird. The actor downs Sour Patch Kids as a pre-stage ritual, but it's a post-curtain call visit that still gives her a rush. Sonia Sotomayor came to the play and said, the work that you all are doing is so important right now. I really, really trust her, so I'm going to choose to believe that. Kelly O'Hara, role Kate. Lily Vanessi and Cole Porter's Kiss Me, Kate. I think the great American playwright is often writing about the things that they weren't allowed to talk about in their own homes, says O'Hara, who sees theater as a type of therapy. People go in and wonder why they have these guttural reactions, why their heart just burst. Kerry Washington, role Kendra Ellis Connor in Christopher Damos Brown's American Son, a Netflix adaptation, will air later this year. I choreographed my own dance to the Nutcracker for the Kindergarten Holiday Show, says Washington, who returned to the stage after 7 seasons of Scandal. I was always carving out a space for myself. Lucas Hedges, role Daniel Reed in Kenneth Lonergan's The Waverly Gallery. I suffer from stage fright, and when I see someone give an incredible performance, it's as if they suddenly have superpowers, says Hedges. Awe is an amazing thing to experience, and from a young age, theater brought up awe in me for other human beings. Jeremy Pope, roles Ferris Jonathan Young in Terrell Alvin McCraney's Choir Boy and Eddie Kendricks in Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations. People are longing for stories that they have known, but to be adapted to say something else, says Pope, who had just 3 days between his Broadway debuts. I love when theater has opportunities to heal and to dissect the stories for what you will, not offering you the answers. And Ethan Hawke, role Lee in Sam Shepard's True West. If someone saw me in Henry IV, it means a lot more to me than if they saw Training Day. We were together for Henry IV, says Hawke, referring to intimacy with his audiences, screen versus stage. They might have seen it the night I had a cold, or maybe it was New Year's Day and I was hungover. Thank you. For the players, Bryan Cranston wears a suit by Paul Smith in lavender, a pink shirt by Charvet, black shoes by Carmina Shoemaker, coral socks by London Sock Company, and a watch by Rolex. Jez Butterworth wears a vest and pants by Boss in black, an ivory-colored shirt by Charvet, and a watch by Rolex. Laura Donnelly wears a light pink dress by Christopher Kane, jewelry by Chanel Fine Jewelry. Audra McDonald wears a dress by Giorgio Armani, earrings by Chopard. We can't tell the color of the dress because that photo is in black and white. Karen Olivo wears a black sheer dress by Valentino with ruffles on the sleeves and at strategic spots. Earrings by Cartier High Jewelry. Celia Keenan Bolger wears a dress by Hermes, earrings by Graff. Kelly O'Hara wears a dress by Louis Vuitton, earrings by Cartier High Jewelry. Kerry Washington wears a dress by Rodarte with a ruffled skirt and fitted top. Spangly shoes by Jimmy Choo, tights by We Love Colors, and earrings by Cartier High Jewelry. Lucas Hedges and Jeremy Pope wear neon-colored suits by Versace, shoes by Converse. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Vanity Fair Part B airs on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, both available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.